call this lecture walls and walk factors. And that is where, instead of having the extra dimension curled up on a very small scale and the killing vector, there being a killing vector associated with this compactification, instead, I want to have this notion of being strongly localized on a surface with possibly quite large extra dimensions. So this is whereas the idea of Kaluza and Klein was like a century old, this idea of localization is more like about 40 years old, although in a more modern perspective of large extra dimensions, it's really more like 20 years old. So, in many ways, we're using that Gauss-Kadatsi formalism here. So the idea is that somehow our physics is localized on a submanifold in a higher dimensional space-time. And so we have to kind of convince ourselves that that might be a sensible thing to do, and then to discuss how this localization happens. So in each case, I want to motivate this by using toy models, because you know the toy models are calculationally more simple, and you can be explicit. So I want to start off by giving the example that was developed in the 1980s, which was a toy model due to Rubikov and Shaposhnikov. So I want to think about a solution to a very familiar looking field theory. So I want to think about a real scalar field that has a potential that's a double well. So this scalar field, there's a symmetry of this Lagrangian. It's a discrete symmetry. Phi goes to minus phi. So from your courses in field theory, you'll know that when you choose a vacuum here, phi is plus or minus eta, you break that discrete symmetry. So this is a sort of classic type of spontaneous symmetry breaking potential. But it's about the easiest that you can imagine. So, usually, you're doing, if you meet this in field theory, and you're discussing spontaneous symmetry breaking, you'll pick a vacuum and quantize around it. But this is a gravity course, so I'm always kind of leaning away from quantization. And instead, I want to talk about something different that can happen in this particular theory that's a consequence of there being more than one possible choice of vacuum. So usually in spontaneous symmetry breaking, you pick a vacuum which then breaks the symmetry of the underlying Lagrangian, but kind of as a consequence of the choice of the fact you have a choice of vacuum, there's usually more than one vacuum, and that leads to interesting possibilities. So consider the field configuration, where I'm going to pick a coordinate z, and I'm going to say that phi is some profile. So phi actually interpolates between the plus vacuum and the minus vacuum. So this is an example of a field configuration which on one side of space is in one vacuum and on the other side of space is in the other vacuum. So let me just convince you that this is actually a sensible thing to do. So my phi primed So if I just look at the derivatives of phi, I see that the second derivative here, because one minus tan squared is sec squared, I can write this as 1 minus phi squared on eta squared. And here, this is just phi, and that's again 1 minus phi squared. So this here, write them in explicitly. So my phi prime looks like sort of a square root of the potential, but my phi double primed is actually the derivative of the potential. So this configuration I've written down solves the field equations of motion. So what this is saying is that as well as having two distinct vacua, where you put phi is either plus or minus eta throughout the whole space, this is like a separate, non-trivial sort of vacuum configuration. So I can't change this field configuration is distinct from either of these, because if I wanted to make a transition to phi being uniformly constant, I would have to take, for example, all of this space over here and lift it to being at plus eta, which is an infinite energy barrier. So my tanh, this kink solution interpolating from one vacuum to the other, is a stable solution. So we call this solution a domain wall because it's got one normal direction, which is the z direction. And so if I were to sketch it in three-dimensional space, I'd have this surface z equals zero, which is where my wall sits. So that's kind of what my wall would look like. So let's now ask what the energy momentum tensor of this wall is. So I just we saw how to compute energy momentum tensors when we were discussing the gravitational action. So I just write down what the energy momentum tensor is for a scalar field. But then I notice that phi primed is just related to the square root of v. So here, this first term gives me phi prime squared whenever A and B are equal to Z. And then inside here, I get plus V plus a half phi prime squared GAB. But my phi prime squared is 2V, so I end up with 2V into GAB plus delta AZ, delta BZ. So you kind of recognize this as the first fundamental form. So what that means is the energy momentum of this object looks like a cosmological constant, kind of parallel to its world volume. However many dimensions we're in. So we kind of call this a brain. So notice that V, which is proportional to such to the fourth root lambda e to Z, is strongly localized. And the integral of V, sort of through the wall, which would give us a sort of energy per unit area, so what we have here is a picture, rather like a sheet of paper, of something that's very strongly localized, that's planar in our co-dimension one. It's planar if we lived in four dimensions, it would be hyperplane in five dimensions and so on. So this is something that is sort of quite physical. It has some sort of, we've got something very definite there. And it's roughly a submanifold because it's very strongly localized. So what we have here, our domain wall, is approximately a co-dimension one submanifold. So these topological defects began to be investigated in the 70s when people were, understanding field theory, but also trying to think beyond just looking at the particle excitation. So they noticed that typically, spontaneous symmetry breaking is something that underlies the standard model. And so what are the consequences of having vacuum manifolds, these choices of different vacua. And so the topological defects were these families of solutions that were topologically stabilized and extended. So they're extended solutions, many of them. And so people were thinking about, what might they tell us? So Rubikoff and Shaposhnikov came up with this interesting idea that maybe we could be in a five-dimensional space So five-dimensional light Kalitza Klein, but unlike Kalitza Klein, there's a domain wall in this five-dimensional space, which is itself a four-dimensional submanifold, and maybe that is our four-dimensional universe. So it's completely polar opposite to Kalitza Klein, because in Kalitza Klein, the extra dimension is a killing vector, whereas here, it's the opposite of being symmetric, it's very strongly localized. So why would that work? I mean, it's all very well to say we have a submanifold, but why might we think that we live on this submanifold? So the example here is that if we have one of these topological defects, that means we have a non-trivial field configuration. And if we then couple other fields to this scalar such that the other fields get a mass that is, or the other fields coupled to the scalar in such a way that the scalar determines their mass, it might well be that outside the wall, particles are massive, but inside the wall, they are massless, and therefore they would prefer to live on the wall. So this was the example that Rubikov and Shaposhnikov looked at. Suppose you get the phi giving you a mass term for some other field. So here I'm just looking at a simple fermion field. So here in the wall, when phi is roughly zero, the fermion is roughly massless, whereas outside the wall, it has a mass of g eta. So what this means is that our lowest energy lowest energy configuration for the fermion is not actually psi equals zero, which it normally would be, but it turns out it's actually preferential for psi to have a non-trivial profile in the background of this wall. So that's known as a condensate. If we look at the various solutions to our equation of motion for the five-dimensional fermion, we see that if we decompose it into a chiral part, then there is a solution for this field here, this psi zero, as long as it's got a profile that looks like Sech. So we have this picture of the wall energy being strongly localized, and then our fermion profile looks something like this. So our general solution would be something where this psi zero, this prefactor, was a massless four-dimensional chiral fermion. So that was just what they noticed, that you could get these condensates, but it was, I mean, condensates and zero modes had been noticed obviously before that, but what was interesting about their paper was they said, well, actually, if you have one of these condensates, the condensate is localized around the wall. So from our perspective, living in the wall, it's as if we just have a lower dimensional massless chiral fermion. So it's as if we've got sort of our low energy theory is effectively four dimensional. So, I mean, that's the sort of idea anyway. So that's just talking about field theory, but from a rather different non-perturbative perspective. But of course, this is a course about gravity. So what happens if we have gravity? So let's now think about these walls from a gravitational perspective. From a gravitational perspective, we might think that we've got a problem because although our wall has a finite energy per unit area, notionally that area is infinite. So how are we going to deal with that? I'm going to discuss this in the context of a specific model with a large extra dimension, which is the Randall-Sundrum model. And this lives in five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. So we'll see how we can incorporate one of these walls in a five-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. So I now want to forget about the field theory and just take the gravitational information, which is that the energy momentum tensor is localized on a codimension one surface. And looking for a wall solution, I'm just going to take this brain energy momentum. So gravitationally, I'm going to say that TAB is a bulk piece, a lambda G5AB, plus something localized on the wall. So this is effectively a delta function, but we could imagine it as perhaps being something that's just very strongly localized. So this gives me, this is going to give me my anti-de Sitter bulk. This is my brain energy momentum. I'm going to set this to zero initially to discuss the wall, but this would be additional matter. And I want to come back to it at the end.
Shouldn't that last TAB be different from the first TAB?
Yeah, I realize. I'm going to use TAB at the end, so let me put this with a five. So I'm going to write down what the background solution is, and then I'm going to justify it. So my metric is going to be of the following form. So I'm putting Z because I called Z my transverse direction. So this is my extra dimension. Now here, what I've done is I'm going to obviously show that this is a solution, but I'm putting my wall at Z equals zero. So for codimension one, I can always choose a coordinate system where my wall sits at z equals zero. I integrate geodesically off the wall, and so I define z as being the proper distance from the wall, and then what's left of the metric simply lives in the remaining four dimensions. So we kind of already, I think last week sometime, we looked at computing the curvature tensor for metrics that were sort of combinations of block diagonals. So we had something, in that case, I think we had a squared. So we had a sort of a squared times something that was p plus one dimensional. And then we also had some other spatial component. So here, this is just a special case of something that we've already computed. But now I'm going to kind of use that, what we derived when we talked about the boundary term, which were the Israel equations. So here my n looks like dz. So my kab at z equals 0 plus, which is minus gamma zab nz. So that's going to be a half gab comma z, which is minus 1 over L HAB, which becomes 1 over L eta mu nu at z equals 0. So we have that we showed these Israel equations that the change in KAB was equal to, so the change in KAB was equal to this energy momentum of a surface. So here, I notice I've got Z2 symmetry, so delta K is just the jump in K. Is just twice the extrinsic curvature by symmetry. And for the pure wall, this SAB, the energy on the hypersurface, is just proportional to the metric. So that was what we kind of got in the middle board there. So if I put in this, my delta K, to the Israel equations, I get minus 2 on L HAB. Then I've got to subtract delta K. So the trace of delta K is just twice the trace of K plus, and the trace of K plus is minus 4 on L. So this becomes plus 8 on L, HAB, and this is going to be 8 pi G sigma HAB. So that tells me sigma is 3 over 4 pi GL. So I have a solution. This solution I've written down represents a wall at z equals 0 with constant brain energy momentum, and we tend to call this tension rather than energy. But the energy is fine-tuned with respect to the cosmological constant. So here, if I call this star, so So that's my background solution. So therefore, I might imagine that although this is just some background wall, maybe I can actually include extra fields and have them localize on the wall. But if I want equivalent of Kaluza-Klein theory, which means I want all my physics to be localized, then I have to tackle gravitational physics. So one of the things, I think probably one of the reasons why, one of the reasons why this sort of extra dimension was not particularly explored is that people probably had this notion that if you had some large or some infinite, in this case, direction, that gravitationally you would be able to see that extra dimension, and it would have all sorts of excitations because, you know, in Kaluza-Klein theory, we had a cutoff for the wave functions in the extra dimension, and that led to a high mass if the extra dimension was small. Correspondingly, if an extra dimension is infinite, you'd think you had arbitrarily low energy excitation. So you'd think that your gravitation, your graviton, would be five-dimensional, and that's what you would see. Even if the particles that you're made up of, the particle physics, is confined on the brain, even if all particle physics is confined, so we are confined, we still see geometry. So we need to make sure that the geometry we see looks four-dimensional. And at the moment, there's absolutely no reason to think it does because the extra dimension is infinite. So we have to kind of think about how gravity behaves. So I'm going to do this in two ways. The first way is going to be just looking at the Gauss equation and looking at what it implies for this k plus ab. So I'm going to rewrite the Israel equations. So I'm going to keep symmetry, the Z2 symmetry. And then I'm taking the Israel equations where this delta K is now 2K plus. I'm tracing it so that I can take this term on the other side. And that gives me a trace of this S. So now I use the fact that S, which is the brain, the total energy momentum in the submanifold, is a brain term and some additional piece. What I see is that my extrinsic curvature is the term that comes from the brain energy momentum. So this is what you're getting when you look at how that flat surface actually curves in the negatively curved manifold. And this is what you get if you have additional matter. So then, if I recall the Gauss equation, So this was the Gauss equation that we got for our submanifold. I then use the fact that my bulk here, if I assume that the bulk remains pure ADS, I can just replace this with 1 on L squared times various components of the metric. So what I get for my Ricci tensor I trace my four-dimensional Riemann to get the four-dimensional Ricci, and here I just get the trace of the K pieces, but here I'm tracing on A and C, and I'm using the fact that my Riemann tensor is a constant curvature, constant negative curvature tensor. So I've got this expression, but then I use this expression for K, so I'm going to leave that as an exercise. And this is what I end up with. So what I want to draw your attention to here are a couple of things. If I just look at this combination here, TAB minus T over 3 HAB, that's a four-dimensional tensor in the sense that it's something that has only components parallel to the brain. But when you think about the four-dimensional Einstein equations, normally we write them as the Einstein tensor is 8 pi g TAB. But we could trace the Einstein equations in order to eliminate the minus a half r GAB and take it over to the other side and turn it into a T GAB. So normally with the Einstein equations, what we do is we say that in 4D, let's put it over here, if we trace the Einstein tensor, we get minus R, and that equals 8 pi GT. So our Einstein equations could be written as RAB is 8 pi g TAB minus a half T GAB. So that's in four dimensions. So the Einstein equations, as they're conventionally written, don't have any dimensionality in them. But this is specifically, this factor of a half is specifically four dimensional. So here, where I have TAB minus a half TGAB, this is exactly the right tensor structure for the four-dimensional Einstein equations. This combination, though, here would be the five-dimensional Einstein equations. So it's this one-third, okay? So what we deduce just from this rather sketchy argument here is that provided I keep my bulk being pure ADS, my Gauss equation tells me that the Ricci curvature of the surface, if I don't just have a pure brain, satisfies to leading order something that looks like a four-dimensional Einstein equation plus t squared terms. Now, if our t is subdominant to the brain tension, which it should be to be in, you know, we want to think of the wall with things just perturbatively happening on it, then this final term is subdominant to the other term. So we set G Newton, which is our four-dimensional G, is G on L, so our G here is a five-dimensional G. So what this is saying is simply that, yes, gravity actually does seem to look four-dimensional. But maybe this argument was too quick, and maybe we shouldn't have said that the bulk was still ADS. So for the last bit of the lecture, what I want to do is to take care of that concern by actually doing a general perturbation of this brain. And part of that particular argument is also going to have a little bit of a discussion of perturbation theory in gravity, which is again something that you should at least see in an advanced gravity course. So let's now perturb our setup. So now we're going to do a different argument, which is perturbation theory. So here is our background, the wall, which is nice and flat, living at z equals zero. So this is our g naught, which is e to the minus 2 mod z on L, e to mu nu, so if I now do a perturbation on that, what I expect, it's not a very straight wall, is it? Is that I might have a wobbling wall and I introduce perturbations in the bulk. So the wall moves and the bulk fluctuates. So that's what I've got to be able to describe. So it seems, if we think about what we could alter of our original configuration, we can make the metric change, but we could also imagine moving the wall. So let's recall that when we calculated the variation of Ricci, when we were talking about the Einstein action, so I apologize for the notation, but it is conventional to call the first fundamental form HAB, and it's also conventional to call the perturbation of the metric tensor HAB. So I'm sorry, that's just what people usually write. So from now on, H is not going to be the first fundamental form. It's going to be a perturbation of the five-dimensional metric tensor. So this is our delta RAB, and now I'm going to reverse the covariant derivatives. So in other words, I want to alter the order of differentiation here. And so I've swapped the grad C to be right next to the HAB. And the price of doing that is each time I swap an order of differentiation, I use the Riemann identity for every single index. So I end up with four Riemann terms. So this combination now is called the Lichnerowicz operator that acts on HAB. And so our Lichnerowicz looks like Lichnerowicz has all these terms in it. You've got the wave operator acting on H, you've got a Riemann term and a Ricci term. And so this is the curved space wave operator for HAB. So this is the wave equation for a massless spin to excitation. And this term, the reason for reordering differentiation, is that you can show that this term is a gauge term, and you can choose a gauge which is called the Donda gauge. Where that divergence vanishes. So if you didn't have that piece there, then it looks much more like a sort of standard wave equation for a spin two particle, because you've got your box, and then, you know, having these additional curvature pieces is sort of completely reasonable, that you get curvature corrections to the wave operator. So for this Randall-Sundrum now, I want to come back to this. I can choose this de Donda gauge in the bulk. That's not the problem. But the wall being curved, is it really curved or is it just a change of coordinates? So what we're going to do is we move the wall back to z equals zero by a coordinate transformation. So remember, our coordinate transformations are generated by vector fields. And so we have this idea that if our wall is moved, all we kind of do is we say, well, we just move it back, you know? And that just gives us a function. The amount the wall is shifted is just a function of the four-dimensional coordinates on the wall. So remember, the change in GAB is the Lie derivative of GAB, and that is going to be grad A psi B plus grad B psi A. So now I'm going to write, just for shorthand, the warp factor is going to be a squared of z. So what I want is to try and be very careful about fixing my gauge to do perturbation theory. I'm going to have it be D'Onda in the bulk. I now want to bring the wall back to z equals zero so that I know how to apply boundary conditions there in a simple way. So when I move the wall back to z equals zero by this translation, I potentially pick up cross terms. So that means I need to introduce a coordinate transformation within my brain to kind of get rid of those off diagonal pieces. So I do that by specifying a coordinate shift on the brain. So I define my psi mu to be proportional to grad f in the brain, and that keeps my metric without any diagonal pieces, z mu pieces. So what that tells me then is that my perturbation is going to be of the form, it's just going to have pieces lying in the brain. So I choose, it's actually stronger than the D'Onda gauge, I choose that my H is trace-free and divergence-free. So this is called transverse trace-free. So this is now my general fluctuation, vacuum fluctuation on the brain. So if we want to think about how our brain reacts to matter, what we need to do is to construct a Green's function for our wave operator, or propagator, if you like, for our graviton. And that means I need to know what my full spectrum of solutions are to the wave equation. So what I have to do is I have to solve that Lichnerowicz set of equations. So let's first look at the ZZ piece. So there's no contribution from the tensor bit, the transverse trace-free bit, and the only contribution that I'm getting is coming from the F term. So that would be sourced by the trace of the energy momentum tensor. So I look at my five-dimensional Lichnerowicz equations, I look at the ZZ piece. So you can see it's a bit of work working all that out because I have to put in what my background Riemann is, my background Ricci. And so there's a lot of cranking the handle here, but this is what it all boils down to. And so what this tells me is that my brain bending couples to the trace of the energy momentum tensor. So I put matter on the brain and the brain's going to move in response. So the mu nu, Lichnerovich, so this is the general equation of motion parallel to the brain. And I just want to draw your attention to the fact, this is what my Lichnerovich gives, is that there's the one third there. So to find our propagator, I'm going to, inside the brain, everything's just flat, so that's kind of a normal flat space, e to the I p dot x eigenfunction. And then I'm going to look for eigenfunctions of this form, where m squared is p squared. So this um is going to have sort of see this part of the wave equation. So this is sort of standard decomposition, separation of variables to find eigenfunctions. And so this now is in a nice Sturm-Liouville form, and we can find solutions. What we kind of do is we simply do a change of variables to get rid of these exponentials, and then what we end up with is a Bessel equation. And so we simply look, we know what the solutions to the Bessel equation are. There's the Bessel functions and the Neumann functions, and we then use the fact that we've got the boundary conditions at z equals zero, or we're trying to reconstruct that delta function to find what the actual eigenfunction is. So there's a lot of kind of fairly heavy calculational detail, but I just want to give you the bottom line. So you construct the Green's function And it all turns out to look like propagators for massless scalars. The tensor bit is just contained in that polarization term. And then, interestingly, you have a whole infinite tower of massive, massive sort of wave functions, massive propagators here. So our transverse trace free H, the solution for that, would be our solution. So at first sight, you might be worried that it has the wrong structure. You've got a third and not a half. So you might think, well, okay, so maybe the gravity is still inverse square, but it isn't actually going to give me the right light deflection because it has the wrong tensor structure. But remember, the brain bending piece our actual perturbation on the brain is a combination of this, what looks like the massless spin 2, plus that F term. So if I now look at the zero mode piece, so I'm not looking at the integral over M, I find H mu nu, which is, of course, H transverse trace free mu nu minus 2 F on L eta mu nu plus L F comma mu nu. And this is just a gauge piece. Now has the correct structure. So once again, we find that we've got the Einstein equations to leading order. And then the correction due to the integral over dm for a point particle is that 2gm over r goes to 2gm over r into 1 plus 2 L squared over 3 R squared. So we do indeed get corrections to Newton's law, but they're not overwhelming. They are in fact at the scale of the anti-de-Sitter curvature. So depending on the size of L, you know, the inverse square law for gravity is only verified down to sort of, well, actually, I don't know what the latest one is, but it's submillimeter. It's certainly not verified down to nanometer scale. But a nanometer, if L was a nanometer, for example, that's huge in particle physics terms. So, and a nanometer would give us some hierarchy between a five-dimensional and a four-dimensional Planck scale. So this is really why people got interested in these types of warped compactifications, because it gave a mechanism for having large extra dimensions without having large extra corrections locally. Our particle physics is constrained on quite small scales, but gravity is not so constrained on small scales. So we can have gravity being modified, certainly at the nanometer scale, without having any direct observational consequences. So this was kind of why people got interested in this. It was a means of having hierarchy between a fundamental Planck scale and our four-dimensional Planck scale. So it was an alternative to solving the hierarchy problem. Right, so that sort of basically completes the story of ideas of extra dimensions. And so for the final two lectures this week, I want to go back to the two sort of themes of thermodynamics, because I think thermodynamics of black holes is always a lot of fun and interesting, and also picking up a little bit on this theme of non-perturbative solutions and what we did with that Euclidean, sort of pseudo-Euclidean quantum gravity. So we're going to look at non-perturbative quantum processes. Stop.